Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So chances are you've never heard the name Smedley Butler before, but if you have, it's probably in the context of one of the wildest conspiracies ever hatched against an American president. The plan was never executed thanks to Butler, and the political and media class kind of collectively decided not to talk much about it, so it has almost entirely faded from memory. The simple version, though, is that leading reactionary politicians and business leaders plotted seriously to overthrow FDR by marching on Washington with thousands of disgruntled veterans led by an unimpeachably principled Marine Corps general. The problem came when the general, Smedley Butler, exposed the plot and turned them all in. That may have been the capstone to Butler's life, but what he did before that was also of enormous consequence for the development of our politics, of our foreign policy, of our presidency, everything. Basically, we are who we are, for better or for worse, thanks to what Smedley Butler did over the course of his fascinating and blood-soaked career. He was involved, one way or another, in American interventions in Cuba, the Philippines, China, Honduras, Nicaragua, the Dominican Republic, Mexico, Panama, and Haiti. He emerged from that journey the nation's most celebrated pacifist, the man who first exposed the creation of the military-industrial complex. He would know, he said, because he built it. Or at least, he was the man at its center who made sure that it did its work. If you think of American imperialism in the late 19th and early 20th century as a virus, today we're living with its endless variants and mutations, which continue to infect governments around the world. Some of the strains have hit multiple countries. In July, U.S.-trained Colombian mercenaries assassinated the Haitian president. And despite, or perhaps because of, evidence that the Haitian prime minister may have been involved, the U.S. is standing behind that prime minister. Some of the same mercenaries involved in that assassination were also brought into Bolivia ahead of its last election with orders to assassinate the protege of Evo Morales, Luis Arce, who was running for president. You can read about that connection over at The Intercept and check out our previous episode on the scheme in Bolivia. Now, they failed, and Arce won in a landslide. And that reporting, by the way, has led the new Bolivian government to charge the former defense minister and request his extradition from Brazil. They played clips of this podcast at their press conference announcing it. Our guest today, Jonathan Katz, is the author of the new book, Gangsters of Capitalism: Smedley Butler, the Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire. He previously lived in Haiti and can get us up to speed on the sprawling investigation into the potential role of the U.S. in that assassination. But first, the story of Smedley Butler. Jonathan, welcome to Deconstructed.
Hey, it's great to be here. I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Well, I'm a big fan of this new book. Terrific work. Congratulations. I think it's a real achievement.
Thank you.
So to tell, like, Smedley Butler has to be one of the most fascinating American lives ever lived. And to tell his story, I want to let's kind of set the scene for the historical period, and you can cut in when you feel like you want to. But coming out of the Civil War, obviously we have a period of Reconstruction that lasts for 10 to 12 years, gets annihilated by a combination of an economic crisis and white terror down in the South, which means that the 1870s, 80s, 90s are spent in a new national project. It's not going to be the national project that was envisioned in Reconstruction, which is making a genuine democracy of all of America's citizens, a multiracial democracy. It's not going to be that. It's going to be Jim Crow, and the energy needs to be directed elsewhere. So you have the railroad construction, you have Manifest Destiny, you have the ongoing genocide of the American Indian population and the expansion out west. And then you talk about how this project, which morphs into a global imperial project, starts to bring the North and South together, mm-hmm. becomes something that forges the United States back into one, and also allows kind of the men of the United States to start feeling manly again. Because these are the people born after the Civil War, and so they don't have the kind of heroic experiences that their fathers and grandfathers had to talk about. This is also, you know, as modernity is coming into being, people are living more comfortable lives. Women are demanding actual rights, political rights, economic rights, and all of this is causing men to feel rather insecure about themselves. And one way to feel more secure, and one way to continue this great expansionary project, is to find new places to expand to. And around this time, Smedley Butler is, what, 16 years old?
Yeah, that's right.
When he's so he's the son of a member of Congress and doesn't want to be a boy who's just the son of a member of Congress. And so, like boys for centuries, you know, he thinks he can forge his manhood in battle.
Mm-hmm.
And so he finagles his way into the Marines, very quickly gets sent off to Guantanamo, and from there leads a life at the, you know, front end of the spear of American imperialism for the next several decades. And the things he participates in are resonating to this day. Fascinating to me that he first winds up in Guantanamo.
Right.
Speaking of refracting through to today, how is it that this young kid winds up in Guantanamo?
That's a great question. And to add one other bit of complexity to Smedley Butler's personal story. So, you know, as you know, he's the son of a congressman. He's also a Quaker. He comes from a prominent Quaker family, really two prominent Quaker families on both his mother's and his father's side, the Butlers and the Darlingtons, on Philadelphia's main line. And, you know, he essentially gets caught up in a war fervor. I mean, as you did a really good job there of laying out all the things that lead up to this moment, the specific catalyst at that moment, we're in 1898 now, is that there's been a growing war caucus, calling for American involvement in Cuba. It's composed of both Cuban exiles. Cubans have been a Spanish colony at that point for over three centuries, and they've been fighting for their independence for, you know, nigh on 30 years. And they've been, some of them, not all, but some of them have been trying to, you know, encourage Americans, you know, to send the U.S. military. But, you know, and there are Americans who want to do that, you know, most notably Teddy Roosevelt, who at the beginning of this is, speaking of finagling, he's the New York City Police Commissioner. He finagles a job as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And then basically, you know, almost, I mean, really, to the extent that one person can start a war, I mean, he came pretty close to doing it himself. He's agitating from within William McKinley's administration to go to war in Cuba. And you know, he writes an important memo that says, if we get this war declared against Spain to liberate Cuba, let's also go for the Philippines at the same time. And so Smedley Butler is a 16-year-old. He's a high school student at what's now called the Haverford School. It was called the Haverford College Grammar School.
I've been to the Haverford School. It's a ridiculously ornate kind of old school European feeling.
Yeah, it's a rich.
I stumbled into it once, but it was just mind-blowingly kind of ridiculously privileged looking.
Yeah, I mean, it's anybody who's ever spent time in Philly, like the main line, it's the main line. It's the rich, you know, it's the extremely posh and old school WASP part of town. And you know, Butler's a high school student, and this war fervor is starting. There's a lot of resonances here, especially with the buildup to the war in Iraq, because, you know, you're dealing with a real tyrant in the Spanish Empire, much like, you know, Saddam Hussein was legitimately a awful human being and an awful tyrant. And, you know, the Spanish are, inventing a process that they call reconcentración, which gets translated into English as concentration camps. They are, you know, starving and killing civilians. And it's in that moment that the McKinley administration and Teddy Roosevelt send a warship to Havana, the USS Maine, to basically, you know, oversee U.S. business interests in the middle of this spiraling civil war. And the Maine explodes. Nobody even today knows exactly why the Maine exploded. It seems like it was, you know, most likely an accident, you know, just sort of a result of poor design of the ship. And the McKinley administration, actually, contrary to popular belief, does not outright blame the Spanish, but they also don't say anything as, you know, the tabloid press, the famous yellow press of you know, William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer run these just completely irresponsible articles, you know, based on horrible sourcing that, you know, oh, we have a guy in Havana and he overheard a conversation and the Spanish were saying, yeah, we did it. And it's this combination of things that gets Butler to want to go and join this war. There's a huge mobilization for the reasons that you're saying. I mean, you know, people were feeling left out. Their fathers, and in Butler's case, his grandfathers, had, despite the fact that they were Quakers, by the way, had fought for the Union in the Civil War. That was because that was, you know, something of a special case because
Quakers were leading abolitionists.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And the Quaker meeting tries to stop Smedley from going, but his mother intervenes on his behalf. And Butler lies about his age, you know, claims to be 18, but he's 16, and joins the Marine Corps. And the reason he ends up at Guantanamo is because, you know, the Marine Corps up to that point had been, you know, essentially a rump service of the Navy. I mean, for most of their life as a service branch in the 19th century, they were just kind of glorified ship guards who, you know, occasionally, like, you know, if something needed to be done on, you know, Tripoli or Japan or something, and you needed guys with guns to get off the boat and, like, you know, guard the docks or raid the warehouse or whatever, you sent the Marines. But this is America's first overseas war. And so while the Army, which has been, you know, spending the previous decades, you know, committing genocide and land theft against the native peoples on North America, while they're getting their act together to get on these converted boats and go to Cuba, the Marines are the only force that's available that knows how to, you know, get a bunch of guys together, give them guns, put them on a boat, and then get them off the boat on the other side. And the Marines land initially at this harbor on Cuba's east coast, Guantanamo Bay, and they come ashore and they seize it for the United States. And so that's why that is where America's involvement in the Spanish-American War begins. It's where America's overseas empire begins, and it's where Smedley Butler's career begins.
And you can imagine a 16-year-old boy who's reading this journalism, because he, you know, we now know, you know, and probably if you were educated enough at the time, you could probably see through some of the propaganda. But a 16-year-old reading those papers, you know, really thinks that the dastardly Spanish are blowing up the ship. And also the Spanish are dastardly in a lot of ways in what they are doing on that island. And he has kind of a historical analogy that isn't too far in his past. And that would be, you know, the French helping out the Americans in the American Revolution.
That's right.
And so I can imagine a 16-year-old thinking, well, I'm going to be like Lafayette.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go over and I'm going to help the Cuban revolutionaries, you know, overthrow the imperialist Spanish.
Yeah. And of course, like, you know, the idea that the Cuban revolutionary fighters are called Mambises, and, you know, a lot of them have been fighting for, you know, 30 years. The idea that, like, this that, like, the Mambises, like, that what they were waiting for was
Smedley, yeah, Butler,
a 16-year-old from the Haverford School
from the main line. Yes,
but, you know, that's America.
But so then Smedley shows up, and I thought it was interesting how you note that a bunch of the Marines sympathize much more with the white-looking Spaniards and are shocked to find out that the revolutionaries they're helping out are black. Mm-hmm. They're like, wait a minute, and it doesn't fit with their idea of, you know, of what they're over there to,
yeah,
do.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, so after he's basically started this war, he then goes to fight in the war. And he forms a volunteer unit called the Rough Riders, which are named, it's a name from popular culture. It came from Buffalo Bill's Wild West show and Rough Riders of the World. and they can't bring their horses, so they're actually not even riding. But they, you know, after the famous Battle of San Juan Hill, which is where Roosevelt's fame is really made on a national level. Roosevelt starts, you know, telling these stories about like cowardice on the part of the black soldiers who were fighting alongside him, because there were, you know, the Buffalo soldiers were in the battle with him, and he's just making things up and lying and just defaming them. And also, by the way, the Cubans are there, you know, a lot of them are black or mixed race. And, you know, all the Marines specifically, the Marines are all white. I mean, there aren't non-white Marines until 1942, until the Second World War. And a lot of the Marines, and this actually starts coming in to an even greater extent as Butler's career advances, come from the South, from specifically the Jim Crow South. They weren't sure what to do with it. And that then ends up informing what the U.S. government does next, which is, as soon as the war is won against Spain, we betray the Cubans. We also betray the Filipinos. And in the case of the Philippines, we just colonize them outright, which is a campaign in which Butler was personally involved. And in the case of Cuba, because of essentially a compromise in the declaration of war between the racist expansionists and the super racist isolationists, who, you know, at that point had no use for Cuba because slavery was outlawed in the United States, and didn't want, you know, the non-white and Spanish-speaking and Catholic Cubans to become part of their country. As part of a compromise, a clause gets written into the Declaration of War that basically says that the United States won't annex Cuba as a colony, but we kind of do it a de facto way, and the thing that we do take outright and have never given back is the place where the Marines landed, where Butler began his career at Guantanamo.
And you had talked about how when Fidel Castro finally took over, you know, he said he was, you know, finishing the job of the Mambises, mm-hmm. and wasn't going to, you know, fall for the same tricks
exactly
that had happened last time. So then, like you said, so then he goes from there over to the Philippines. And his Philippines adventure bookends his Chinese invasion. So let's do China first.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so China in the same year, basically in 1898, an uprising starts. It's a popular uprising among people who practice and believe in a kind of folk magic version of martial arts, and they're attacking primarily Chinese Christians. But also Christian missionaries, and to a lesser extent, sort of the imperial powers who are starting to gobble up China, who have been gobbling up China for decades at that point. And China is still a monarchy, and the Qing Empire sees this group of rebels and thinks, well, we could use these people, and we'll ally with them to maybe, you know, get rid of this foreign encroachment. The foreigners see these martial artists, and not recognizing, you know, what kung fu is, they call them boxers, because that's what it looks like they're doing. They're boxing,
right?
And so this becomes known as the Boxer Rebellion, and a bunch of other things happen. But essentially, in 1900, this eight nation alliance that includes, you know, Great Britain, Russia, France, Italy, Austria-Hungary, etc., and the United States, and Japan, by the way, comes and stages a full-scale invasion. And Butler, at the age of 18, and then he turns 19 while he's doing it, fights his way in from the coast to Beijing.
And this is a side note, but you found a local historian there who said that there's evidence that the British used chlorine gas.
Yeah.
Which would be banned in Europe, but also, you know, significantly before World War One.
Yeah, I was, you know, I speak, so, you know, I traveled all over the world for this book, and I speak a lot of the languages of the places I go: Spanish, Haitian, Creole. I do not speak anything approaching Chinese. But I just in terms of how the sausage is made, I found that, because, I had some documents. I OCR'd them, and then I used Google Translate. And then I then went to, you know, some scholars of China who speak Chinese and know this period to confirm with them that what I was reading was correct. And one of them pointed out, he was like, oh, this, you know, there was a poem it was a poem written around that same time, which my finding then confirmed, you know, one of the readings of this poem, which was that, you know, that this gas had been deployed in a village outside of what's now Tianjin, or a village that was then outside of Tianjin. It's now actually basically part of Tianjin because that's how cities go in China. And yeah, it seems pretty like a pretty strong case could be made that, you know, 14 years before chemical weapons are first deployed on the battlefield in World War I, that the Europeans were deploying them in China. And it actually, the connections there are notable because even the first time that chemical weapons are deployed in the First World War, it's against colonized troops. So, you know, that's a theme that runs mm-hmm. throughout. Like, Europeans are always thinking, oh, well, you know, we have these horrible weapons. Let's use them against people who we don't see as being fully human.
Yeah, and the description in the poem makes it implausible that there's really any other explanation. Like, it's impossible to imagine somebody kind of so perfectly fabricating the like consequences of something that nobody else would have seen anywhere else.
Exactly.
So he takes part in the sacking of Beijing
mm-hmm.
as an 18-year-old.
Yep.
Gets shot in the chest, a button.
First, he gets shot in the leg, thanks to Herbert Hoover.
Right. He'd already been
Herbert
shot
Hoover in the leg. Led his Herbert Hoover, who's there as a young engineer with his wife Lou, leads Smedley and his Marines into battle in the wrong spot at the Battle of Tianjin, and gets a bunch of them killed.
Right. That was an incredible story. A lot of people might not know Herbert Hoover's background, but he was this coal magnate. And he was also this international master of logistics, like one of the first people known. And he did some great things with that. He mm-hmm. he bailed out the early Bolsheviks from mass starvation through kind of a relief package that he oversaw. I think as Secretary of Commerce, he was really heralded for some of the ways that he responded to like the giant flood in 1921 or something like that. He's just really an impressive guy. Up until he was faced with something that didn't match with his ideology. But as a 25-year-old, he volunteers to take Butler's crew. He says, look, I know my way around Beijing. I can get you guys there. Don't worry.
Tianjin.
The master of logistics.
Yeah.
Oh, Tianjin. Yes. The master of logistics really blew it. Like, just took them to a cemetery, right?
Yeah, and the Chinese troops are up on the city walls, and they're just sitting ducks in this marshy field. And Butler says, you know, that he had fantasized about getting shot in battle, but he didn't think it would hurt as much as it ended up doing.
And so then he wakes up on his 19th birthday inside
19th, yeah,
the walls of Beijing, after having been shot and surviving again. He's then the American delegate, you know, to go into mm-hmm. the Imperial Palace after the Empress had fled, while Marines and the rest of the Eight Powers are just absolutely just massacring
and looting
everyone in sight,
and stealing
everything that isn't nailed down, and lots of things that were nailed down, including, I found this interesting, an amount of silver that was then melted down into a bowl that the Ninth still uses at its celebrations today.
Yeah, the Liskin Bowl.
Loot.
Yeah, and they call themselves the Manchu Ninth because of their time in China. That's that, and it's still today. If you meet anybody from the Ninth Infantry, they'll tell you or if at least you say Manchu to them, they'll know exactly what you're talking about.
Right, and so it's around this time he starts to get an inkling. I mean, he doesn't synthesize it yet, but he's starting to realize that there's a little bit more to what he's being sent to do than just freedom fighting.
Yeah.
And Herbert Hoover's situation here actually is instructive. Like, and why is there a 25-year-old, you know, coal mining engineer who is so invested in the Marines, you know, sacking this city in the first place? And so when do you think he's first, because he's going to be an Imperial Crusader for another, for a long, we've got ways to go. But when do you think it starts to fully dawn on him? When does he start connecting the dots about what
he's doing? As far as I can tell, it really starts happening in Nicaragua. So he, in 1909, you know, politics in Nicaragua. Long story short, Butler and the Marines help seize the land for the Panama Canal. They help affect the secession of the state of Panama from the Republic of Colombia.
And by now, he's not just leading units, he's leading
exactly, yeah, entire operations. He's got an entire battalion. It's called the Panama Battalion because it's based in the Panama Canal Zone. And one of the places that the place that the canal did not get built was in Nicaragua. People still talk about building a canal in Nicaragua today. There are, you know, purported projects between the Chinese government and Nicaraguan government, you know, that are constantly starting and stopping. And the president of Nicaragua, you know, is mad at the Americans for not having, you know, built the canal in his country. He starts retaliating against American business interests, including, by the way, Herbert Hoover's also got mines in Nicaragua. A lot of
right.
Smedley Butler is kind of the, you know, he's the zealot. He's like the Forrest Gump of you know, early 20th century American imperialism, but he's not the only one. Like, you know, Herbert Hoover, a lot of these other guys like kind of show up in place after place.
Small world.
It's a very small world. And it's a small club and you're not in it. And Butler is in charge of this battalion that keeps going to Nicaragua to intervene basically on behalf of U.S. business interests and against, they're called liberals, but like they're you know, the Nicaraguan revolutionaries who want to protect Nicaraguan sovereignty. And one of the things that happens during this time is the annexation of the Philippines, which has essentially been completed by this point, was so costly and so embarrassing on a political level because, you know, word of these, you know, atrocities, some of them committed by Marines in the Philippines, has just, you know, embarrassed presidential administrations. At this point, William Howard Taft, who's another guy who's everywhere, he was governor general of the Philippines when the Americans annexed it. He's president now, and he comes up with this idea called dollar diplomacy, where basically instead of you know, taking over a country militarily outright and you know, raising the American flag, you allow them to nominally keep their sovereignty, but you take over their financial system, you take over their central bank. And in the case of Nicaragua, there are two banks in particular, Brown Brothers, which is now Brown Brothers Harriman, maybe notable to some of your listeners because their headquarters is across the street from Zuccotti Park, where Occupy Wall Street happened, and J&W Seligman and Company. Those American banks come in and get a charter and start the National Bank of Nicaragua, which is chartered in Connecticut, and they start a new currency, the Nicaraguan Cordoba, which is backed essentially by the U.S. dollar. And they have the Marines as kind of their shock troops, putting down insurrections, you know, making sure that their guy becomes president, a guy named Adolfo Diaz, who's actually the accountant for one of the American mining companies, not Herbert Hoover's mining company, but another one based in Pittsburgh. And then making sure that anytime rebels, you know, members of the Nicaraguan Liberal Party try to rise up and unseat him, that he's protected by sort of a Praetorian guard that includes Smedley Butler. And Butler at this moment, you know, he's been doing this for, you know, about two-ish decades, and he's achieved the level of major. So he's now, you know, a flag officer. And he can sort of dictate his own movements. He can decide where to go. He can decide who to talk to. And in doing that, he starts to realize, like, wait a second, like, you know, we're not here protecting democracy. We're not here, you know, protecting, you know, the interests of the great American Republic writ large. We're here, you know, because Brown Brothers has got a little money is one of the things he says in a letter to his parents.
Did the fake election have something to do with it? Because he's tasked with making sure that Brown Brothers man wins the election. And he schedules the election for to last like an hour and only tells like six people.
Yeah, they go out and funnel them through the polls and then close the polls immediately after and
like the fakest election you could ever imagine. So let's pause quickly in the chronology to talk about the why of this. And so now we're getting into the early 1900s. You know, the country's effectively settled at this point. You had, you know, in the 1890s, this just absolutely punishing economic depression, and you had extraordinary labor unrest, you know, more violence between, you know, workers and bosses than in Europe and, you know, almost anywhere around the world, probably. Just all of it being put down by, you know, the National Guard, you know, the state coming in and crushing the labor movement in order to keep people happy. You know, you talk about the way that the Philippine adventure was certainly expensive in terms of dollars spent by the government, but the resources that were extracted from the Philippines, the resources coming in from Nicaragua, coming in from China, start to fuel the consumer economy here in the early part of the 20th century that then kind of becomes the outlet for a lot of the unrest and alienation that's coming from the transition that the United States is going through from this kind of yeoman frontier type of society into one that's being funneled into offices and into factories.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. I mean, and so the Philippines, it's really poetic. They are the exact length of the West Coast of the continental United States. You know, and as you note, all of this is happening. So, you know, in 1892, the director of the U.S. Census, famously to anybody who's, you know, been through a high school American history course, you know, declares that the frontier is at that point, you know, for all intents is closed. And a young historian named Frederick Jackson Turner at the University of Wisconsin, he ends up at Harvard teaching future presidents, including Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he, you know, he comes up with his frontier thesis, as it's called, where he basically says that that the American character, like American greatness, was created through this outlet of the frontier, and that the closing of the frontier portends doom. Precisely for some of the reasons that you're saying, like he's you know, one of Turner's ideas is that the reason why America is a classless society, which of course it isn't, right? But this is something that people tell themselves, and something that people still tell themselves.
Right. To the extent it's more classless than say Europe.
Exactly. I mean, we don't. Yeah. I mean, it's not. There is not
at that time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one thing that you can say is that Americans do not even today have as finely tuned a sense of class status and class identity as like say Britons do.
Right.
And Turner's argument is that the reason for this was because there was this outlet of what he calls free land. Now, let's. You know, he completely brushes aside the fact that this land is not free. This land has people living on it who have to be
right.
killed or moved aside or whatever. But you know, that this sort of then, you know, that it's this sort of space where people can go and become men and sort of, you know, in these, you know, alchemical encounters with the savage, you know, vastness, the savage wilderness, mm-hmm. Sort of, you know, become like, you know, a truer and freer version of themselves or whatever. And this is very influential for a lot of people. And the other guy, the other intellectual architect behind this push is a guy named Alfred Thayer Mahan, who is he's a naval theorist, who is the most important military theorist really of the, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century. And his big theory is that navies are more important than armies. And he envisions this great American naval empire where basically, you know, our, you know, ships with guns will lead the way and open markets and defend sea lanes to create this huge American commercial empire across the seas. And these two ideas in concert with each other, they kind of, these become the intellectual framework for what happens. So, you know, the Philippines is, you know, well, we've run out of space to manifest destiny in North America. Let's just go manifest destiny it, you know, due west across the Pacific at the doorstep of China. And, you know, it's arable land. There are, you know, resources. There's this thing called Manila hemp, which, you know, nobody remembers today. Although, you know, if you've seen a rope or go to a gym where you climb a rope, it's probably made of Manila hemp. It's where the term Manila envelope comes from, because it's made of the same substance. But essentially, like, you know, this stuff runs the economy at that time. You know, you use it to make the belts that run through electric generators. You use it to make the rigging on ships. And, you know, China then, as now, represents sort of the great limitless market where you can just go and make all the money you want. The Caribbean and Central America represent places that, you know, you can extract resources, including bananas, you know, produce that you can sell. You can basically, you know, buy for a song and sell cheap to great profit in America. And all of these places are then, you know, hungrily looked at by the banks as places where they can expand American banking, and they can expand financing, and they can finance all these projects. And the thing is that in each of these cases, just as with, you know, the expansion into, you know, across the Appalachians and into the American West, you run into this problem that there are already people there who have their own ideas of how they want to live their lives and who should be calling the shots for them. And that's where you need somebody like Smedley Butler. It's where you need the Marines to come in and use force to kill enough of them and intimidate the rest of them, so that, you know, all of these other big dreamers and greedy capitalists can get their way.
Right, and it's not like these are just some unfortunate injustices that are being kind of waged by some thoughtless and cruel policymakers. They're the things that are floating the system.
Yeah.
They're keeping it going. And so he's starting to recognize this, but, you know, he's a Marine, he's enlisted, and he's going to follow orders. He winds up in Haiti not long after. How long after Nicaragua? Not terribly.
So his last stint in Nicaragua is 1912. In between that and Haiti, we invade Mexico at the behest of the oil companies.
Oh, that's right. And he sneaks into
exactly.
Mexico.
At the behest, by the way, of William F. Buckley Sr., who's the lawyer for the oil companies mm-hmm. in Mexico. And he calls the Wilson administration and says, invade, please. And they do. And then, yeah, in 1915, we and Smedley Butler invade Haiti.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And so what he does in Haiti reverberates today. And in some ways, he is celebrated by, how would I put this, the liberal kind of imperialists say that Smedley Butler in Haiti showed the softer way of carrying out this type of a project. It's nation building. It's hearts and minds. It's counterinsurgency, the kind that Petraeus would point
100%.
To and say that, right, you need to win people over rather than just gunning everybody down. But as Butler himself says, in a letter to his parents, I think, it's not going to happen without a little bit of shooting.
Exactly.
And his definition of little at this point is relative, because yes. he's been shooting now for a decade and a half.
Yeah.
There are so many wild moments of his time in Haiti. But what did you take away from it?
Yeah. So it's like you say, I mean, you know, from the Haitian perspective, you know, he goes down in Haitian history, as they literally call him the devil. You know, he goes down in Haitian history as being the most méchant, as they say in Haitian Creole, the most evil of the Marines. You know, you hit the word counterinsurgency. I mean, essentially what Butler is doing in Haiti is inventing counterinsurgency, and actually it's Butler's adjutants in Haiti, some of whom go back to Nicaragua to fight against the original Sandinistas, whose leader Augusto Sandino is, you know, radicalized by an encounter with Butler's handiwork. He sees the slain body of the Nicaraguan rebel leader who's been killed in battle with Butler's Marines, and declares, you know, lifelong revenge against Wall Street and the Yankee soldiers who follow his dictates.
And Sandinistas are in power today.
Right, exactly. But it's in Haiti and Nicaragua, especially, that Butler and Butler's adjutants, their field notes become the basis for the Small Wars Manual. That's, first of all, still read, you know, as a book itself by Marines and soldiers today. And it also becomes ultimately the basis of the Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Manual that Petraeus and company wrote. And you know, the thing that Butler, it's an interesting detail in the book, and I'm glad you caught it. You know, Butler is operating from within the perspective of the Marine Corps in a more, you know, I would say, like, liberal way than some of his superiors. I mean, he's got this senior officer, his mentor, a guy named Littleton Waller, who is just, you know, just a seething racist, from an old aristocratic Virginia,
burnt the Philippines to the ground.
Exactly, kind of exactly. Guy. Yeah, literally. I mean, he's ordered to kill and burn in the Philippines, and that's what he does. And is court-martialed for it and acquitted. And in Haiti, you know, he sort of wants to do the same thing. I mean, Haiti, you know, represents black freedom, black excellence, black self-liberation, and to, you know, people who, like Littleton Waller, who grew up destroying Reconstruction and you know, laying the groundwork for and then implementing Jim Crow, it's an intolerable example, and they're you know, chomping at the bit to show, you know, to teach the Haitians a lesson in white supremacy. And Butler, because he is, you know, a Quaker from Philadelphia, he has a much more subtle and, you know, I would say more modern, you know, more recognizable today, form of racism, where he doesn't necessarily think of himself as racist, although he throws around the N-word a lot. But he, you know, he certainly, you know, he, like Teddy Roosevelt, to use a prior example, you know, Roosevelt, who's also just a white supremacist. I mean, you can't read, you know, The Winning of the West or the other things you know, Teddy Roosevelt's, you know, ranting in, you know, Tucker Carlson style about race suicide and essentially, you know, white genocide, that like all these immigrants are coming in and overtaking the true Americans, which are, you know, the Anglo and of course the Dutch, because the Roosevelt family came from the Netherlands originally, you know. But nonetheless, like, Roosevelt and Butler, like, have this sort of more genteel northern style of racism, where, you know, they think that lynching is bad, it's very uncivilized, they think that slavery was bad, and that, you know, it was good that you know, the Civil War was fought to end it, but they still look at, you know, people in places like Haiti or you know, black people in the United States as being somehow less than themselves. And because Butler is sort of in that nuance, that is kind of what enables him to essentially invent counterinsurgency, because he's able to look at Haitians a little bit more as individuals. He's able to sort of understand a little bit more of the nuances of local politics. He's able to, you know, he bothers to pay enough attention to the Haitians that he realizes that they don't speak French. They speak their own language, you know, Haitian Creole, and that none of his men speak it and that they should learn it.
A low bar.
A bar that you can marine crawl over. But
not learning the language, but learning that they speak a different language than you thought.
Exactly. Well, it's a way to, I mean, you know, you need that in order to do counterinsurgency. And we see it today. I mean, in the forever wars, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, et cetera, you see modern day echoes of that, where, you know, people are, you know, willing to, you know, work with the locals, and they're willing to, you know, and they're willing to deal with the locals, and they think that, you know, with time and with training, perhaps, you know, the Afghan people could learn some form of democracy. Perhaps they won't be as naturally innate as us. I'm being sarcastic. I don't know if that comes across.
Right.
But that's kind of what Butler is doing. And Butler says these things. I mean, he says these things to his father as a congressman. He's like, you know, in time and with a white man to show them the way, like maybe these Haitians can make something of themselves. But as you note, there's no such thing as a bloodless counterinsurgency. So one of the reasons why Butler is still known today in the circles in which he is known is in the Marine Corps, because he was one of two Marines that received two Medals of Honor. And the second Medal of Honor that he receives is for a massacre in Haiti at a place called Fort Rivier, which is deep in the mountains in northern Haiti. I actually went there in researching this book. And kills a lot of people and basically crushes this initial resistance, which then rises again and then gets crushed brutally again, including by Butler's ultimate creation, the Gendarmerie d'Haïti, which is the model of sort of a local quiet military that gets used in the Dominican Republic, in Nicaragua, and then ultimately in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right, and Butler in this fort, he kind of, He's the third person. He sneaks in through something of a sewage tunnel.
Yeah,
it seems like, and then kind of pops into the middle of these fighters, and it appears at that point that the American weapons really carry the day. That the Haitians have these rifles that don't fire well at close range, don't fire quickly, and it very quickly becomes like rocks and sticks guns.
Yeah, the Americans bring
and against machine,
bring
guns.
Machine guns. Yeah, they bring machine guns up. Some, you know, the larger ones are pulled up by mules. Actually, Butler, I don't even think this fact made it in the book, so I'll just throw it out here in the podcast. Butler actually had a patent. He patented sort of this intermediate technology where he designed sort of a more stable way for a mule to tow a machine gun. This is, you know, something very quickly replaced once mechanized transport becomes a thing, you know, just a couple years later. But yeah.
You're right. A patent that combines a mule and a machine gun is going to be obsolete probably fairly quickly.
Exactly. It was the BlackBerry of 1950.
Yes. And so, so what is the fallout of in Haiti of that particular occupation?
In Haiti, we're still feeling the fallout today. That occupation lasts for 19 years. Which was a record. Technically speaking, the occupation of Nicaragua had the start date and the end date are farther apart, but there was a little bit of time off in between. So the occupation of Haiti was the longest continuous U.S. military occupation until that record was broken in Afghanistan just before the withdrawal. And Haitians that's a complicated story, which we could do an entire podcast about. You could do a podcast series about it, because unlike in other places where Butler was, you know, in Nicaragua, the head of the constabulary force that, you know, Butler helps create, the Guardia Nacional, is a guy named Anastasio Somoza, who becomes, you know, the dictator of Nicaragua, and he and his sons reign as dictators until the Sandinista Revolution in 1979. In the Dominican Republic, the head of the Guardia Nacional is a guy who's also trained by the
Which
Marines.
Where Butler also was,
yes.
Which is, yeah.
He was everywhere. Rafael Trujillo, who...
Right, so he's propping up all the baddies.
Exactly. But in Haiti, Haiti's always got to be a little more complicated. In Haiti, the Gendarmerie d'Haïti becomes, you know, a sort of a new Haitian army called the Guard. And there is a head of the Guard, Paul Magoire, who seizes power in a coup, but he doesn't remain for very long. And so the ultimate big bad dictator of Haiti, and I don't want to sound like I'm making a joke here because, like, he was awful, François Duvalier and his son Jean-Claude, Papa Doc and Baby Doc, they actually, they're a little bit more complicated because they use the centralization that the American occupation created to establish their own system of control. They also use the memory of the opposition to the American occupation as an ideological basis. They even though they are absolutely, you know, ideologically they are fascists, they are 100%, you know, from the right. There's nothing socialist or redistributive or class politics or anything about them. But they often refer to themselves as being a revolution. You know, François Duvalier says, you know, I and the revolution are one. They use this memory of, you know, because one of the things that, you know, the more racist Marines like Littleton Waller, who were there with Smedley Butler, do is they introduce a kind of Jim Crow politics into Haiti, where they elevate, using essentially colorism, they elevate a light-skinned, more Francophone and ultimately Anglophone tiny elite. You know, they see them as being the future rulers of the country. And François Duvalier in particular, he comes up with this idea called, he and some other Haitian intellectuals, I mean, he wasn't an intellectual, called Noirisme, which is basically like, you know, black power against this light-skinned elite. And he says, you know, we're going to replace the light-skinned elite that the Americans created with a dark-skinned elite of us and our friends, and ultimately some light-skinned people too, as long as they're loyal to the regime. And so they end up ruling Haiti until 1986, and we can sort of spool it out from there. But it's,
yeah. Yeah, and it does make sense that you'd have a relationship between kind of national humiliation and fascism, and you obviously see that,
yep,
in Germany, you know, to the extent that Trump's right-wing populism has undertones of it. It's rooted in a similar kind of sense of humiliation. You know, the world is laughing at
absolutely
us.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. And so you could see how a revolutionary movement could use that humiliation as its ideological spring.
And also in China, where Butler and the Marines intervene. Right, a
century
twice.
Of humiliation.
Exactly.
Right.
They still talk about it to this day. And I was there reporting this book for a month, and it was everywhere.
And so let's come back to Haiti,
mm-hmm, sure,
because there's a lot to talk about with the recent assassination of the president. But before we get to that, let's wrap up Butler, who then, you know, who becomes this kind of not just pacifist. Is pacifist too much?
He says at one point, he says, "I'm a pacifist. Hell yes, I'm a pacifist, but I always have a club behind my back."
Right. So, but more interesting than that, he publishes a book which becomes a phenom because he's a huge celebrity, mm-hmm, at this point. He had come back. He had been Philadelphia's police chief.
Yes.
You know, cracking heads in Prohibition, bringing. You know, nothing we export is going to stay abroad. Right. Everything comes home. So whatever we're putting out there now, you know, be ready for it to come back. So it comes back to Philadelphia. Let's linger on that for,
sure,
one moment. Can you also see the roots of the militarized policing that we have today, both in his development of counterinsurgency and then his transporting of it into Philadelphia to fight the mob and prohibition.
Oh yeah. 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 The idea of using, the military methods as a way of reforming urban police, in the U.S., it was gaining currency at that time. That wasn't his idea initially, but that's why he's brought in, is because there's this cry for reform in the Philadelphia police.
And he's still in the Marines, right?
He takes a leave of absence.
Takes a leave. Exactly. Right. Yeah. He's not retired.
No, he petitions, I guess it's Harding for a leave and then Coolidge. Actually, I can't remember at this second. Maybe Coolidge is president at this moment. But anyway, he takes a leave of absence from the Marines to go to Philadelphia. And the idea is that he's going to clean up the police force. He's going to clean up the city. There's rampant corruption in Philadelphia. It's run by a political machine, which was known as the Republican Organization at the time. And prohibition is happening. So there's a lot of gangsterism. There are these big gangsters, guys like, Mickey Duff and Max Boo Boo Hoff, and the Lanzetti brothers. And Butler is basically like, we're going to do in Philadelphia what we did in Haiti, what we did in Nicaragua. And he uses similar tactics. He uses similar language. He draws parallels directly, and says, we need machine guns. We need to turn the back seat around in the police vehicle so we can get a gunman in the back so they can shoot people, from behind. And actually, when I was writing this book, I thought I wanted to be telling a story of Butler's life, but a larger story ultimately the rise and fall of the American Empire. And I was like, well, I'm not gonna make this a biography of Butler. And one of the ways in which I told myself that it wasn't going to be a biography of Butler, I was like, well, I'm not going to deal with like his, Department of Public Safety days in Philadelphia, running the Philadelphia Police Department. And then while I'm writing the book, the George Floyd uprising happens and I'm looking around and I'm like, oh God, I guess I actually have to do this. And yeah. And
right. Cause we, and that's actually a metaphor for the way that we would like to pretend that we can keep all of this elsewhere.
Yep, exactly.
But we can't.
Exactly. And ultimately, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but the reason why Butler is known, especially to people on the left today, as a hero, is because he takes this big anti-war, anti-fascist turn in the last decade of his life. He writes a book called War is a Racket, where he basically, does sort of this, imperfect, but attention getting, and write, essentially, in the larger scheme of things, take on what becomes known as the military industrial complex.
And a tell all of what he did in Nicaragua and who he did it for, exactly. What corporations were benefiting. And
yeah, he writes a series of articles for a socialist magazine called Common Sense. And in the second, like they're all sort of, taking himself to task. The most famous one is the second one that he writes. And he writes this famous confession, as I call it. I quote it fully in my book, where he says, I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys to collect revenues in. That's Citibank, which still exists, by the way. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909-12. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Honduras right for American fruit companies in 1903. He's referring to Standard and ultimately United Fruit there, now Chiquita Brands International and the Dole Fruit Company. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil, now ExxonMobil, went its way unmolested. During those years, I had, as the boys in the back room would say, a swell racket. I was rewarded with honors, medals, promotion. Looking back on it, I feel I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was operate in three city districts. We Marines operated on three continents.
And so then he becomes this.
Fuck yes, Smedley Butler.
Right. Right. So you can see why somebody who comes across that paragraph is ready to elevate and celebrate Smedley Butler. And he was then, extremely useful in shining a light on what he had done, because he had a completely unimpeachable position to speak from, having been the one that, you know, carried all of this out.
And blows the whistle on what he alleges is a fascist coup to overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt and stop the New Deal in 1934. And the reason why those plotters, however many of them there were, pick him is because he has the track record that, you know, he talks about in that confession. But they didn't anticipate the degree to which he wasn't willing to do that at home and the degree to which his own politics had shifted.
When did he publish the confession?
That's from an article in 1935 in Common Sense.
Oh, so that's after they came to him.
Yeah.
Okay. So that is what I had been confused about in the past about Butler, because I hadn't put the timeline together, because I remember thinking this guy has made clear his position here. Why are you trying to recruit him into a fascist coup? He's become a pretty outspoken anti-fascist, but it sounds like he hadn't quite been as public yet.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen online people, you know, quoting Butler as having said that in 1933. I have not found any primary source documents in which I can find that.
And it would make sense that that's not correct, because, or if it was, it was one comment to one newspaper that wasn't picked up. And we could do an entire episode on the fascist coup that Butler says was organized, and that there's very strong evidence that people with a lot of power and money, strangely, if you only think in partisan terms, two of the men involved allegedly were the last two Democratic nominees for president.
Yep.
John Davis and Al Smith.
Yep.
Who are now extraordinarily embittered at the turn that the Democratic Party has taken, you know, toward Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And the allegation is that they, in allegiance with these corporate interests that Butler has been doing the bidding of for decades now, come to him, say they want him to address the American Legion.
Yeah.
Stand up for the gold standard, which Wall Street is utterly panicked about, because they think that, you know, that Roosevelt is going to start busting deficits and start spending money on people,
right,
and that's going to hurt their bottom line, and that they want him to lead a contingent of veterans into Washington and basically become Roosevelt's something like chief of staff. At which point Roosevelt would sign a paper saying that he's a figurehead, a king, a constitutional monarch who doesn't have any authority, and Butler will restore the gold standard and run the country.
It's not actually clear if they wanted Butler to do that, or if they just wanted Butler to handle the military end of it. There's some indication that maybe they were thinking about Hugh S. Johnson, who... If you need New Deal nerds out there will know as the head of the National Recovery Administration, right. He was sort of looked at as being sort of the right wing. He was looked at as sort of the adult in the room by right wingers at the time, that he was sort of this army general who would keep the Bolshevik instincts of Rexford Tugwell and the Roosevelt Brain Trust in check.
And there does seem to be some evidence that he was at least, that he was leaning in that direction, or that he was open to it, or that.
He certainly liked Mussolini. Johnson was a big Mussolini fan. People on the right today, I think, you know, Dinesh D'Souza, in one of his stupid books, tries to use Johnson's like very real admiration for Mussolini and his sort of, you know, he circulates, you know, these pamphlets written by, you know, Gentile about, you know, the Stato Cooperativo, as sort of like, you know, let's try to do this with the NRA. D'Souza isn't smart enough to figure out that he wasn't a liberal. Like he was the conservative in the room, you know, in the New Deal, who was trying to bring in this Mussolini influence, you know, because, you know, it had an intellectual genealogy to it, because Mussolini came out of socialism himself, but then rejects it and sort of comes up with this, you know, pro-capitalist, not capitalist, but anti-proletarian, anti-class politics vision of busting heads. And among other many other reasons why it was a bad idea to get Smedley Butler involved in this thing is Butler had ended his Marine career getting court-martialed for insulting Benito Mussolini in 1931. So,
right.
And
standing by it.
Exactly.
Right. And so there are congressional hearings about this.
Yes.
Butler presents a ton of evidence. Other witnesses come forward that back up Butler. The people that he accused of being involved in this come to the committee and deny things that then are demonstrably proven to have happened. And the media writes it up as that it was cleared, it didn't happen.
Right.
But then if you read to the end of the articles, like on page A17 or whatever, right, then all the evidence is unspooled.
Yeah.
You're like, oh wait, actually, this does appear like it may have happened. When you had finished your research on this, where did you come down on how real this plotting was?
I think that the guy who tried to recruit Butler, Gerald C. McGuire, I think he thought he was the front man for a fascist coup. He said it to enough people. You know, Butler enlists the help of a newspaper reporter, Paul Comely French, who's a reporter for the Philadelphia Record and the New York Post. He says that McGuire said that to him. McGuire comes before this committee. It's a two-man subcommittee of it's actually the Special House Committee on Un-American Activities.
Right.
It's the predecessor of HUAC. And it's John W. McCormack, who becomes Speaker of the House, and Samuel Dickstein, who, by the way, then becomes, at least there's significant evidence that after this, he becomes briefly a Soviet agent of the NKVD. But speaking of just like how crazy this history is, but McGuire, you know, comes before them and he kind of perjures himself and contradicts himself. But even throughout this sort of contradictory, testimony. Enough comes out where he is saying, yes, I met with Butler. Yes, we talked about these things. And essentially, you know, I talked with Butler at all the places that he said we did about the things that he said we talked about, but it's not my fault. Essentially, it's kind of what he's saying.
Right.
And, the other piece of it, you know, is that McGuire's boss, a guy named Grayson M.P. Murphy, had enough of a background in military intelligence and enough, you know, ties to the future OSS and future CIA it would be hard to imagine that it had never occurred to that guy at any point to try to overthrow, you know, FDR. Beyond that, it's really hard to say. And the main reason why it's really hard to say is because the McCormick-Dickstein Committee doesn't, you know, they don't do a full investigation. They don't bring in the big names, you know, the big shots, right, as Butler calls them, to testify. You know, they don't bring in the DuPonts. They don't bring in, Alfred P. Sloan of General Motors, et cetera. And they don't do a full investigation. So, you know, initially Butler's testimony, I mean, it runs on the front page of the New York Times. The Times, you know, gives equal space to the denials of the accused, and then writes, you know, an unsigned editorial mocking Butler. Time Magazine writes this satirical piece called "Plot Without Plotters," where they sort of imagine Butler, they imagine Butler, you know, leading a mob up Pennsylvania Avenue. With Thomas Lamont and Jack Morgan, J.P. Morgan's son, they were the heads of J.P. Morgan and Company at the time, you know, sort of bringing up the rear. Because who could imagine a mob, right, moving up Pennsylvania Avenue,
crazy,
violently trying to, you know, do something to influence the American government? Beggars belief.
Couldn't happen. Speaking of violent overthrows, yes. Back to Haiti. Right. So last July, I might get these dates slightly off, but last July 5th, the president at the time, Jovenel Moïse, mm-hmm, appoints Ariel Henry to be prime minister. Apparently, at the urging of, or he's an ally of the former president, Little Mickey.
Sweet Mickey.
Right. Sweet Mickey.
Yeah, Michel Martelly. Exactly.
I'm glad that you're here because you've spent years living in Haiti, you've been back and forth, so you know you can keep these characters straight better than I can.
I've known Sweet Mickey since before we had the same haircut. That's a joke fly because I'm on the radio, and also I don't want to say that I'm a friend of his at all. I'm just saying I've known him since before I lost my hair is the joke here, and he's bald anyway. That's all.
So July 5th, he is named prime minister. July 7th, I think it was, a group of Colombian mercenaries led by Haitians storm into the presidential residence and slaughter him.
Yes.
And Ariel Henry, not exactly in line, he hasn't even been sworn in yet, but begins to jockey to assume power.
Yep.
The United States backs Henri's claim to the throne, mm-hmm. so to speak. In September, a prosecutor who was tasked with looking into this says that Henri had made at least two phone calls, we now know three, with Joseph Badiou, who was accused of being a lead organizer of the assassination. One call right before the killing, two calls after the killing. Henri responds by ordering the guy's boss to fire him. Yeah. The guy's boss refuses, so he fires both of them and shuts down the investigation. United States stands by Henri, puts out a statement saying that he's their guy. Daniel Foote, who's the U.S. envoy to Haiti, resigns in protest mm-hmm. and cites this in his letter. He also resigns over shipping plane loads of Haitians back into this conflict-riven society.
And the photos of U.S. border guards,
whipping
or whatever they said they were doing.
Whatever they were doing with the...
Throwing their reins toward Haitian immigrants trying to reach the United States. Yes, exactly.
Right. And so Foote resigns. Henri remains in power. I recently reported that you may know her, the former U.S. ambassador to Haiti, Pamela White, mm-hmm. Had said back in March at a congressional hearing, way to deal with Haiti, put aside Moise and find a respectable prime minister that you can put in. She called it the prime minister option. And then he needs to then dissolve the election council and create a new one that the U.S. has faith in. And then we need to call a summit of Haitian leaders and Western allies and name a new leader. That summit, so he did in late September dissolve that election council. Mm-hmm. They did call this summit. This summit just ended a day or two ago, where I guess they're sort of saying they're appointing a president in New Orleans. I guess there's is the Creole connection is supposed to make that legitimate somehow.
I mean, there are academic conferences that call New Orleans part of the Circum-Caribbean, so sure, why not?
Oh, there you go. So we the night that the police had put together a report, it started circulating on WhatsApp in Haiti, and we obtained a copy of it. And Haitian investigators, have tons of people involved in this saying that they met with people who said they were FBI agents, said they were State Department people. Lots of people involved in this are saying that they only got involved. The financier of it said that he only funded it because he was told that the United States was supportive of it. One way I think to read that would be to say that the United States has a couple different ways of carrying out coups, and as you've talked about here, there's the you burn things to the ground, like in the Philippines. You do some dollar diplomacy, you do some counterinsurgency, or you set up situations in which local elites take matters into their own hands, and the United States winks and nods and allows it mm-hmm. to go on. That this feels like the latter version of it, but you know Haiti a lot better. What's your read on what happened and what's going to happen next?
Putting back in the context of the book really fast, like, I mean, that's something that I really tried to bring out in Gangsters, is, how much of this is more complicated than just, the Americans coming into a place and imposing their will. I mean, we're using local dynamics and, you know, partnering with local elites and looking at local fissures, you know, in the same way that Butler did, you know, at a hyper-local level, you know, with counterinsurgency, you know, figuring out how to navigate the divisions between, you know, the Caco insurgents and the villagers who weren't sure where they stood. You know, we also do that at a macro level. And part of the reason why I was able to come into this project writ large with that perspective is because I've seen that happen so much in Haiti. I mean, you know, the United States, it always shocks people, and then they often quickly forget, you know, how much imperial control the United States has from, you know, behind the scenes in Haiti. You know, it may seem like it's just sort of natural law that you have like this, you know, big, powerful, wealthy country, you know, up here and this smaller country, you know, 2-hour flight from Miami, and that's how the relationship would be. But there was nothing natural about that. Like that was, you know, the product of years of individual decisions and a lot of violence dating back to the first U.S. occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934. So Henri, you know, he becomes prime minister essentially via press release. I mean, the core group, which is, you know, sort of a consortium of, you know, the most powerful ambassadors and I guess like representatives of the OAS and the UN, they just, you know, sort of issued a press release and they were like, okay, he's the prime minister now. Like, that's not a way to, I can't even imagine how, you know, even the prospect that, you know, that the Russian government may have, you know, spread propaganda or tried to do some hacking on behalf of one candidate in the United States, you know, set off, I think rightly, like, you know, a freak out. Mm-hmm.
We can be annoyed by that.
I mean, it's two wrongs don't make a right, but, you know, we just do that times 1,000 in Haiti. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, you've got, you know, a lot of Haitian groups. There was this huge group called, you know, known as the Montana Group, because they met at a hotel in Port-au-Prince called the Hotel Montana, which was destroyed in the earthquake and then partially rebuilt. And, you know, this broad consensus of groups from all over Haitian society came together, you know, to lay out a path forward, you know, for creating a new electoral commission and holding new elections when the country is ready for them, and sort of, you know, trying to, you know, create space for something approaching a democratic will to be lived out in Haiti. And, you know, the U.S. government, the Biden administration, has just flat out ignored them. It's the same imperious attitude toward Haiti that followed the last time a Haitian president was assassinated with the killing of Vilbrun Guillaume-Sam in 1915. And it all comes, you know, and it's about, especially, you know, in that first occupation, you can, you know, very clearly lay out, you know, the through lines of the reasons for, you know, Citibank getting involved. And there were these outstanding loans that Haiti had taken out to pay back this, you know, intolerable indemnity that the French had levied against them after the Haitian Revolution. And they were worried that their loans weren't going to get paid back. And so they, you know, send the Marines ashore to stage a bank heist, basically, on behalf of Citibank and other Wall Street banks. That's what sort of occasions the assassination of Vilbrun Guillaume-Sam, and then that assassination happens. By the time you get to the 21st century, when I was living in Haiti 2007 to 2011, and now, you know, in the aftermath of the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, like, you know, to a certain extent, it's almost muscle memory. I mean, there's no real point.
What about the resources, the mining? Like, what wealth is on Haiti that might attract U.S. interest?
The only U.S. economic interest that I've ever really been able to discern in my, you know, whatever it's been now, 12, no, I moved there 15 years. My God, 15 years, my 15 years of covering Haiti, is sort of, is cheap labor. You know, under, Jean-Claude Duvalier, baby doc in, especially in the 1980s, there was this period where, you know, these cheap garment assembly factories, you know, were making things, you know, for instance, you know, there was a time when every baseball used in the U.S. major leagues was sewn in Haiti, you know, mm-hmm. Disney toys and Sesame Street toys and Cabbage Patch Kids dolls and, you know, all these things. And, you know, when the Clintons got involved in Haiti, after the earthquake, in 2010, they had already started to be involved. They already started to get, you know, very involved again in 2009 before the earthquake hit. That was sort of their angle. They wanted to see Haiti kind of, you know, go back to its sweatshop model of cheap labor for, you know, U.S. corporations to give us a place that's closer than China to outsource. In terms of like material wealth, I mean, there is gold. You know, there's gold mined in the Dominican Republic. I know that because I've been to the mines, but it seems like a big headache to try to get it out of the ground in Haiti. And I've never really seen anyone, you know, who knows mining make the persuasive argument that there's this enormous wealth right. of gold that is worth the cost of extraction and also the cost of doing business in a country as unstable as Haiti is. You know, there's rumors of oil, maybe, I don't know.
We do it because it's what we do, because what Smedley Butler taught us how to do.
That's honestly my honest answer. It really is. It's just that this is what we do. I mean, it is our, you know, you know, right now in Ukraine, right, with Russia, and I'm not a Russian apologist. I'm not trying to say that like invading Ukraine is good. It's not. But you know, Tony Blinken, you know, has you know, he's made these arguments that like, oh, you know, well, Russia thinks that Ukraine is in its sphere of influence, but you know, spheres of influence are barbaric. We don't do things like that anymore. Bullshit. Like Haiti is in our sphere of influence. That's really why it's, you know, it's because we can, and it's because, you know, Haiti is looked at in global politics as being the responsibility of the United States in this very paternalistic, you know, Eurocentric, you know, white supremacist or, you know, whatever way.
Well, right. And the more cynical view in Haiti that has been pitched to me is that Moise's trip to Turkey was the last straw.
Oh, that's interesting.
That his face turned toward Turkey, which is allied with, you know, they're not our best friends nowadays. Yeah. And they're better friends with Russia and China. And that him getting on a plane and actually going to Turkey and taking that meeting was considered a breach.
That's interesting.
Of trust. It busts our sphere of influence, you know.
I don't want to get so far afield, but like Moise is a fascinating character, cuz like the dude came out of nowhere. I mean, he was just supposed to sort of be a placeholder. He was supposed to be kind of the Medvedev to Martelly's Putin, right? Like that he would just sort of come in and keep the seat warm until Martelly came back into power. And then instead he kind of does the dictatorial turn himself, except there was no powerful central government left to be dictator of. You know, he was mm-hmm. you know, the Haitian government, you know, for years has kind of existed in name only. But yeah, that's honestly as best I can tell. And you know, who knows? Maybe at some point the great gushing oil well will be found and all will be revealed. But like, you know, like the whole Clinton cash thing, you know, I went down all those rabbit holes. I climbed up the hills. I went to look at, right. you know, I looked into the PVC pipe in the hill where, you know, Tony Rodham, you know, supposedly had his big gold mine, and I've just never seen any of it. I think insofar as there is a U.S. interest, I mean, Joe Biden said it himself when he was a senator, that you know, he made this horrible statement during the Haitian migrant crisis in the early 90s, that whatever it was, Haiti could rise up, you know, I forget the number. It was like Haiti could go rise up 3 miles or sink under the ocean, and it wouldn't make a difference in terms of the U.S. national interest. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's horrible. Can I say it's a fucked up way?
You can.
This is a fucked.
No FEC rules here.
Okay, it's a fucked up way of looking at the world, but ultimately it's true. It's not. This goes back to Butler. You know, by the time the U.S. invades Haiti in 1915, you know, Haiti has been beaten down enough even by that point that it has ceased to be an important place in and of itself. There aren't even material resources that the United States particularly wants there. We want it for its sea lane. You know, we want it because we don't want the Germans to come in and you know, get a beachhead, you know, across the Windward Passage from Guantanamo Bay. You know, Citibank wants to protect its investment. People are looking at ways of sort of making money on the side. But ultimately, we're an empire. And when you're an empire, you don't need that big a reason to invade and occupy and blow up another country.
And it shows the way it's on autopilot, in the sense that even with Biden as president, who had said he doesn't care if Haiti sinks into the sea, the U.S. still, at a very minimum, we can say, is standing behind the de facto prime minister who is credibly accused of being involved in the assassination of the president.
Yeah, and protecting him.
We can also guess at more U.S. involvement there. But even without that, we know that the Biden administration is doing that. And we also know the Biden administration, or Biden himself, doesn't care about Haiti at all, yet is still doing it. So that,
because why not? Because it's a flick of the wrist. I mean, the epigraph of my book is a Haitian proverb.
I saw that.
By Coublier, pote mak songe, like the one who deals the blow. That was my translation, deals. But the one who deals the blow forgets, the one who carries the scar remembers. And that is still the way. I read your story, I guess it was yesterday, right, about our chicanery with the Central Bank of Afghanistan. That's something straight out of the occupation of Haiti and of Nicaragua. You know, it's the other mm-hmm. Cliche is that, you know, when the empire sneezes, you know, the world catches a cold. It's like with a flick of the wrist, we flatten a country, and it means nothing to us. We're not doing it because we hate these people. We don't even know they exist. We don't care. As long as our shopping carts are full and our paychecks come in on time. And ultimately, as long as, like, you know, the biggest, you know, and the, you know, as long as Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk's, investments come through, that we don't care what happens to anybody else. That's what it means to be an empire. And to be on the opposite side of that is what it means to be colonized. And as we were talking about, these things have a way of coming home. But the empire still stands, and these things are still, the gangsters of capitalism are still out there in 2022.
And the Haitian proverb explains why Smedley Butler is widely known in Haiti, but completely unknown here, though I hope that changes a little bit. People enjoyed learning about his story, and I wanted to thank you for sharing it and for the book.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Katz, and that's our show. Deconstructed is a production of First Look Media and The Intercept. Our producer is Zach Young. Laura Flynn is our supervising producer. The show was mixed by Brian Pugh. Our podcast fellow is True Gwynn. Our theme music was composed by Bart Warshaw. Betsy Reed is The Intercept's editor-in-chief. And I'm Ryan Grimm, D.C. Bureau Chief of The Intercept. If you'd like to support our work, go to theintercept.com/give. Your donation, no matter what the amount, makes a real difference. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show so you can hear it every week. And please do leave us a rating or review. It helps people find the show. If you want to give us feedback, email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. Thanks so much. See you soon.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.